1, 2, 3, you go ahead.
1, 2, 3, bonjour, ça va?
You speak French, there you go. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Innov and Crea. Today, my guest is Rebecca Root, a British actress. Welcome, Rebecca. You're an actress, theater trained. You did TV shows, very prolific films. You're also a voice coach. You're an activist. Before we get into that, I want to ask you the question I ask every single one of my guests, which is, the root question, and no pun intended, when you were little, I don't know, like 10, 11, 12, what were you fascinated about or interested about, curious about, or passionate about?
That's a very good question.
That's what most guests answer.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, it's not an unusual question. It is a good question because I get asked a lot about my life journey, if you like, and the choices I've made along the way and the choices that have been made for me mm-hmm. along the way, because believe it or not, some choices are out of our hands and you just have to follow the path rather than make the path. But I think it's probably fair to say that even before the age of 10, 11, 12, even as early as 4 or 5, 6 years old, I wanted to be on stage. I wanted to act. I wanted to make people laugh. I wanted to move people. I wanted to make people think about the world. Of course, this is not the vocabulary I was using as a 6-year-old because I didn't know that these are the things that we can do as actors. But I knew that I had a certain ability and I knew that I liked being on stage. Now, some people call that just being a show-off, and there is a lot to be said for that definition, that a lot of actors are just show-offs. But I think that I realized at this early age that I had a desire to be part of storytelling. And I suppose part of that also is reading and writing. And telling stories through writing fiction and poems and reading aloud. I just always loved the process of storytelling. So I suppose that's really why I've followed this path. I want to be a part of a story-making community, whether that's art, spoken word, written word, or whatever. I suppose I think about the only form of storytelling that I haven't particularly engaged with is physical storytelling and dance. I have 2 left feet. I honestly am a rubbish dancer.
Was it so clear that you just went to high school and then decided to go for it?
Yeah. I mean, I did school plays like a lot of kids do, but a lot of kids do school plays and never do them again. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 13, 14, I also used to do magic shows for children's birthday parties when I was a kid. So I was like a teenage magician. I was booked, both semi-professional, if you like. I was at school and at the weekends, I did magic shows. I did my first school play when I was probably about 5 and then just regularly throughout my years. But there was a teacher at my high school. So I suppose I was about 13 or 14 years old. And he just sort of identified something in me that he encouraged. And he helped me audition for a program called the National Youth Theatre of Great Britain, which is a youth theatre and it's the national program. It's a summer school. It was founded in the 1950s. And I was a member in the 1980s. You know, you just go to London for the summer. You do classes and you put on a play. And it was wonderful. And it kind of gave me the sense that I would love to pursue acting as a professional career if I could. And this same teacher who encouraged me to and helped me and coached me getting into the National Youth Theatre then coached me on my audition speeches to get into drama school and, you know, helped me get to conservatoire training. So I suppose then a lot of people, when they're in their teens, they try for college, drama school, and they're told, no, go away, come back in a few years, get some life experience and come back with a bit more maturity. And I didn't want to do that, which I suppose is a very indicative of immaturity, that you just want to crack on with it. You just want to get going. And I didn't want to delay. I didn't want to go out and work in an office for a year, or I didn't have the money to travel the world. I knew what I wanted, and I took the place that was offered to me as an 18-year-old coming from school. And I trained from a relatively early age, I suppose, as an 18-year-old. It was a difficult few years, nothing easy about training, but it was incredibly rewarding and enjoyable. I learned so much. You know, I still hear the voices of my tutors in my head, sort of. I think that's the sign of a good teacher. If you can still remember catchphrases and things that they told you 35 or 40 years ago, and that person is still at the back of your head saying, you know, don't do that, do this, try this, what about that, have you thought of this, then that's the sign of a good teacher, right? That they're still with you. So yeah, that was drama school training. And then of course, when you leave drama school, you're in the big world. And as an artist, as a you yourself know what it's like. Nobody hands it to you on a plate, and the path then is just as difficult to navigate as before. And it was difficult, I must say. I mean, it was my whole career has been challenged and obstructed by my troubles with my gender identity all my life, really, but particularly my career. Because as a male presenting actor, I wasn't quite comfortable in my skin. I wasn't really free, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe these things, I don't know, even in the 1980s, maybe these things would have come up if I'd taken that year off or 2 years out before drama school training. Perhaps I might have then, in that pause, had chance to reflect. But that was the 1980s, and it wasn't really a period of great tolerance or understanding of people with gender diversity. And I just kind of buried it. And of course, when you're then trying to make a living, that's difficult. If there's something there that's under your skin and bursting to come out, it interrupts you.
In interviews, you say that then it puts you in a place where you're acting yourself and you're acting a role, because you're not aligned with who you really feel you are deep inside, right?
Yeah. I mean, we have this in, let's call it, you know, civilian life. You know, it's, even the non-actors who are listening to this conversation will recognize when you've, you know, got out of bed and you feel a bit sad, you feel a bit sorrowful, a bit depressed, whatever, you know, and you have to go to work, whatever that work is. Go to an office or work in a shop or, I don't know, whatever you do. And sometimes you have to hide that, and you have to kind of get on with your life and get through the day. And that's hard enough when you have those sort of jobs, you know, or you that kind of lifestyle where you really don't have very, you know, you're not on show.
Yeah, if you're not doing what your calling feels like, regardless of gender, you know, like just, that's
but
hard
the
enough.
The point is that you're then, this idea of sort of double acting, which is kind of like what you said about how I described this before, it's like you're acting and then you're acting. You're acting yourself and then you're acting the character.
It's exhausting. It's got to be exhausting. I mean,
yeah, it's exhausting. What I'm trying to say is that I think people who aren't actors would, I think, I hope, appreciate the difficulty of going into work and putting on a face and saying, yeah, hi, everybody, I'm fine. And trying to do that when you're acting is doubly, sort of quadruply so, if you like. It's not just going into work. It's then going into work in order to go into work. That makes sense.
Yeah. No, it does. And I think actually that's going to be a segue to something that I want to share, which is one of the things I find most magical in life is serendipity. And I think I want to tell how serendipity played such a big role in us meeting up 10 years ago, because I think it's that's how it is that today we have this chat, which is wonderful. So just quickly, 10 years ago, 2012, I'm in London. I'm doing an MA in design. And I made a friend, her name, and I might as well say hello to Sarah Tagdemy, that I haven't seen since I left London. Talented illustrator, wonderful young woman. And she was looking for a flat. She needed to move out into something different. And she asked me to tag along to visit flats in London. We go around flats and then we get in front of this huge Victorian building, like so impressive, ring the doorbell. And this tall, slim, really sleek brown hair woman answers the door wearing a bright yellow t-shirt and goes, "Hello," with this wonderful voice. And that was you. So I remember that so vividly, striking. Wow. And so we go around and we visit the flat. You had two other flatmates because people have never lived in London. I mean, it's expensive. Everybody lives with with some sort of people that are not necessarily even friends. You know, it's such an interesting, you know, cosmopolitan cities bring and allows you get to meet a lot of people. Anywho, so we're visiting the flat. And eventually, Sarah decided to choose a different flat, but I needed to move out the weird place where I was staying. And I said, "Oh, how about I try and get in the flat?" Because I really loved it. I loved just it was such a great vibe. So I contacted you. I said, "Can I have an addition?" Because we're auditioning, of course, people, you know, to live with the three of you. And I got in. And I was so excited. And so that's how we got to meet. And we lived with two other people for, most of 2012. But I knew your work. I remember going to see a play. But right off the bat, we didn't discuss, why would we? Why would I even ask that question? But I didn't know about your life journey. I didn't know that you necessarily were a trans woman actress. But one of the things that really struck me throughout this year was I could sometimes hear people in the den having voice coaching sessions. And every time I think about it, I'm serious, it moves me. And eventually I found out that you were helping men who were transitioning, becoming women, on how to use their voice accordingly to the new life, you know, they would adopt. And I just always thought it was such, I mean, can you imagine the difference you made in these people's life? I just thought it was just wonderful. We never talked about it. I never met any of them, but it always remained such a vivid and very moving memory to me.
So
that's why I wanted you on the podcast, because there's so much to talk about and it's so inspiring. But then becoming an activist and an inspiration for everybody. So you've had such an inspiring career. You played in the movie The Danish Girl. You played in The Queen's Gambit. Right now you're playing at the Shakespeare's Globe, right? Such a prolific career.
Yeah.
But one show that was paramount to paving where you're at now was Boy Meet Girl. I would love for you to explain to us how getting this role in a sitcom produced by BBC changed your life and why it was so important.
Well, Boy Meets Girl is a comedy about a man in his mid to late 20s who meets and falls in love with a woman who's in her late 30s, turning 40, in fact. So there's a bit of an age gap. In reality, it's about 12 years, you know. I mean, I don't know why people get so hung up about age, for God's sake, but an age gap. But it could be because the older person is female and the younger person is male, and that's a relationship that's not. I mean, there are lots of older women in relationships with younger men, but we don't see a lot of them. So there was that element of it. But I suppose the principal component of the story is that my character, the older woman, was not only older than the lad, but also she is trans. So we see a relationship between an older woman and a younger man where that woman is trans and the man is a cis male. So in that respect, the story of a cis trans relationship, it's not commonly told, it's not often seen. And I think Boy Meets Girl did a lot to sort of demystify trans experience. I mean, we are way more common than people think. And there are any number of people that you could think of who have trans partners and they're cis. But this show was the result of a script writing competition that was run by the BBC. And we made a pilot. which was then commissioned for a full series. And we did two seasons in 2015, 2016. And my career kind of changed from the first season, but it really changed after the second season when I coincidentally changed agent. I went with a new agent, a theatrical representation, who just had a few more connections, mm-hmm. and they were a slightly bigger agency than my previous agent. There's nothing wrong with my previous agent. I was very fond of her. I've been with her for years, but we'd sort of just outgrown the relationship. And I went with a new agent who then sort of was able to get me through the door for films like, you know, The Sisters Brothers and yeah. Colette, and TV shows like The Queen's Gambit, The Romanovs, Flack, Heartstopper and Sex Education, and a lot of these shows which you come to when you reach a certain point in your career and you're with an agent of a certain size and you start getting those auditions. And then you make contacts and your name gets better known and then people start asking for you. I'm at an interesting stage of my career now where I definitely do more TV than film, and I certainly do more TV and film than theatre, but I love theatre, as I always have, and I also love TV and film. But, you know, I really just take whatever feels right and whatever really I'm attracted to at the time, what I have time and availability to do.
You know, it's amazing just to be able to live of your art practice for anybody, right? And then on top of that, being able to do that aligned with who you always felt you were, doing what you always wanted to do. So that's amazing. Yeah. But I think there are roles that you had that are really important, and people might not understand why, in terms of being a trans woman playing cis women roles, and people are surprised. And then you're like, yeah, but there's a bunch of cisgender people playing trans. So why wouldn't the opposite happen? And it seemed to have happened quite a few times for you. And it's a big deal. It's a big deal because it should be like that anyways. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to think which parts I've played that are cis. I mean, certainly in the Sisters Brothers and in Colette and in the Danish Girl. Forgetting half my CV now, but yeah, it is funny, isn't it, that people say, oh, you know, gosh, you're playing cis, why would that be such a big deal? But I mean, it's about representation, and it's about having opportunity to play those parts. And you know, if you asked people who've employed me, they would say that there's just something about me that they felt worked for the character. So if you spoke to Scott Frank, who made The Queen's Gambit, he didn't know I was trans, so he tells me. He didn't know I was trans when he cast me in The Queen's Gambit. He just said, well, I had the qualities that he was looking for that character.
He was and casting in fact, an now, actress for a role, you know? Yeah. And that's what I find is wonderful, is moving fact, this conversation towards talent, period.
Yeah, exactly. And he's just cast me in... I just was filming his next show, which is called Monsieur Spade, which I think you'll probably quite enjoy in French Canada, because it's a French English language detective series.
When is it coming out?
It'll be sometime in the autumn, I guess.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't know exactly when, but I'm guessing it'll be sometime in the autumn. And I do play a Brit, but I have some French dialogue. But there are a number of, most of the cast is French. And I would say probably 65% of the dialogue is French. So there's quite a lot of English dialogue as well, but it's an extraordinary piece. I think it's hugely ambitious, but I think it will be extraordinary and wonderful. People will either love it or they'll be scratching their heads going like, what's that? You know?
Oh, intriguing. Very intriguing.
Yeah, but I play a cis character in that as well. And again, it's with Scott Frank, who made The Queen's Gambit. And so he just wants me for the part, you know, irrespective of the fact that I'm trans, which is pretty special.
Absolutely. Can we talk about your work as a voice coach? If I remember correctly, you had done your MA on aspects of using the voice, and why pick that subject as an MA, and how did that translate into being a coach?
Well, where I did the MA is the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. It is a famous conservatoire drama school, but it also has this component for training voice teachers. And a friend of mine had done this MA 3 or 4 years before I did mine, and he loved it. He kind of encouraged me to apply. And at the time, I wasn't acting. So I thought, well, I don't want to give up acting, but I do want to do something other with my life than, you know, to pay the rent. And I want to do something with actors. So I did the course, and I chose voice studies because I have a profound relationship with my voice. I had a relationship with my voice when I presented male. And when you transition, you have a very difficult relationship with that process. Some people change their voice entirely, some people not at all, and some people just a little bit. And I went to quite some lengths to try and change my voice, but I also grew to accept my voice as it is. And even now, I still get called sir sometimes on the phone.
Oh.
Because people hear my voice and they say, well, it's a deep sound, so it must be male, without realizing that I'm trans or whatever. It doesn't really matter. 20 years ago, I was a lot more concerned about it, and I was more anxious about my voice. So by doing the MA in voice studies, I made myself the subject of my thesis, and I wrote about my journey of my vocal development and my vocal transition. And I wrote this in a thesis, which I then had published in a speech journal. And I developed a workshop version of my thesis, which I presented at conference in Harvard and in Oslo and in Mexico City. And, you know, I began taking my work out to the world. And that's when I started getting private clients, because there is a demand in the community for vocal transition. There was certainly 20 years ago, 15 years ago, maybe less so now, because I think now, I don't actually know, but I think people are more comfortable with their gender now. And if people are trans and are transitioning somehow, it's not such a big deal to keep their voice as it is. I don't have any statistics to demonstrate this, but I feel that people are more accepting of different gender presentations, and that does involve vocal profiles. So I always said when I was teaching voice that my ultimate aim was to make myself redundant. Because who cares about what your voice sounds? It's what you say that matters, not how you say it, really.
It's such a personal, it's like a fingerprint, right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, everybody's used to hearing different accents, so that's nothing unusual. And we hear gender differences because society is conditioned to hear certain vocal types which say male and female. And to humans, that helps us kind of navigate interaction with people that we don't know. So we hear warm tones, we hear aggressive tones, and we therefore read a situation accordingly. That's what we do. It helps us compartmentalize society. That's why, you know, until relatively recently, society was very binary with male and female. Boom, that's it. Thank you. Black and white, male and female. And of course, now we're a lot more blended, and people are having all sorts of different gender expressions, non-binary amongst them. And those people are, in a way, changing the vocal environment in which society is conducted. And that's great, because who
more
cares?
Diversity.
Like I say, who cares what you sound like?
And you're a voice actress, right?
I haven't done any dubbing. I've done audiobooks and audio drama and video games. I'm in the Harry Potter Hogwarts Legacy playing a character called Serona Ryan, which got a lot of people very upset. A lot of people say that J.K. Rowling is a transphobe. They say that my character, Serena Ryan, the inclusion of this character in the game is just a sort of a cursory nod to the trans community. But the reality is that J.K. Rowling didn't really have anything to do with the game, and the developers wanted to have a trans voice in the game for whatever reason, and they chose me to be that character. And really, it was a job like any other job, and it paid the rent for a month. And so that was, you know, it was just, it was very interesting when that game came out to hear all the comments, because people didn't know it was me.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people thought it was a male actor playing Serona Ryan. And then people got upset about that, because they were saying, well, the character is female or trans female, and why is a male person playing it? And then a few people realized it was me, and they said, no, that's Rebecca Root. I recognize her voice from other work. I know her. She's trans. That's her voice, you know. So that kind of was interesting because it kind of it shut up a lot of people. A lot of people just want to pick a fight in the world, you know. Really, life's too short, isn't it? I think we've both found in recent months in our personal family lives that life is too short. Yeah. And really, let's just get on with life and live together and live and let live.
Yeah, and support each other, you know. You refer to the fact that we both lost our moms and just a few weeks apart. It's always, you know, such a big deal and quite an experience of mourning as well. Do you have other projects coming up? Are you excited about stuff that you can talk about?
Before I started on the theatre job at Shakespeare's Globe, I'm doing Midsummer Night's Dream at Shakespeare's Globe at the moment. Before I started that job, I was up for a TV project. I hope this TV job, which I can't really say the name of, I hope that comes to fruition, because if it does, it would be a nice bit of work in the autumn. So who knows? But in the meantime, I was very busy last autumn into the winter. I did 4 TV shows of varying sizes of parts. I suppose the biggest part was the one with Scott called Monsieur Spade, Clive Owen, and a French actor called Denis Ménochet, who's quite a big name at the moment in French cinema. And that was a great part, and that I'm really hoping that that sort of opens a few more doors. There's another show called Annika with Nicola Walker coming out, and a show called Crime by Irving Welsh, who made Trainspotting.
Yeah,
there's a few interesting shows coming out in the next probably in the next 6 months.
Also, so The Rising.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about The Rising. Yeah, yeah, because that was a great film.
You're busy.
I should have had my CV printed out, and then I could just talk about them all. But yeah, The Rising, I did love that part. And we filmed in some of the most beautiful parts of the UK.
Yeah,
in the north of England, really gorgeous scenery. It was a lovely job. That was filmed in 2021.
Oh,
about 2 years ago now. My partner was doing that 2 years ago.
Oh wow!
Incredible how time goes.
Rebecca, what are your hopes for the future? You're presented as an advocate for transgender actresses or the LGBTQ+ community. Is it still something that you carry?
Well,
do you just, you know, just want to be a woman who's an actress? You know, like,
yeah. I mean, you know, there are two parts to that question. What do I hope for the future? I hope that I just continue to get work and earn enough money to keep a roof over my head with my partner, and, you know, just to sort of have that balance of work and private life, which I enjoy at the moment. But in terms of being an advocate, I mean, the thing is, I will continue to speak out when necessary, but I often feel that there are other people who are better placed to speak out than me. And I don't always have something to say. It's not to say that I don't want to say anything, but, you know, I was invited on to national news, the Today program on BBC Radio 4 last week. And I declined the invitation because, A, it was very early in the morning. And B, I just felt I wasn't sure if there was anything I could add to the debate. So I choose my interviews with more discretion, I think, now. Because I think other people are more, they maybe have more insight into something than I do. I'm really just, I was thinking about this when I declined that invitation to be on this news program. I feel that I want to be known for what I do, not for what I am.
Yeah.
So I want people to, if they want to hear me talk, then let's talk about acting and voice, but not because I'm a trans person. I know that Kate has come into our conversation, but I think the fact that I am working, doing the work that I do is interesting rather than the fact that I'm a trans person. Although I accept that there is a certain amount of, what's the word? I can't think what the word is, but...
I think it's very interesting because perhaps that took a lot of place publicly at a time where Boy Meet Girl came out. I'm wondering that, you know, so there was a lot of talks around that, the identity, instead of the work itself. And I think it's very interesting if you can now allow yourself to move towards just talking about acting. I was wondering, are there roles that you always dreamed of playing that you would like would be offered to you in the future?
Well, I mean, I'd love to play Hamlet. I'd love to play Rosalind in As You Like It. I'd love to play either of the Macbeths, Lady or King. I absolutely loved playing the detective in The Rising. I loved that. That to me was a great role. And then I keep talking about Monsieur Spade because my character is not all that she seems at first sight. I can't say too much because I don't want to spoil it. But, you know, she's not all that she makes out. And playing that kind of slightly unknowable character was such joy. Besides which, it was a period piece, so everything was 1960s.
Wow.
1960s vehicles and costumes, and you know, it's going to be such a stylish piece. And I just had the best time. I was playing quite a posh person, so I put on my finest cut glass English accent, and you know, it was just a wonderful and joyful role. It really, really, really was the most fun.
It sounds delightful. And, now we're really looking forward
I can't wait to see it. And it's the sort of part that I would jump at to do again, to play again, if there was a second season or something like that. I don't know if there would be, but it would be the sort of part I would jump at to play again.
In some interviews, you have a lovely advice for people to find themselves or to be aligned. Or is it still the same advice you have? If you look back, what would you tell Rebecca?
Oh, God, I honestly don't know. 10 years ago, an awful lot has happened in 10 years, hasn't it?
And 30?
and 30. I think I would tell myself, and I would tell anybody listening who is struggling, that it does get better, that although it feels like the end is nowhere in sight and you feel like you're in a very dark tunnel with no light at the end of it, light does appear at the end of the tunnel. It may be a long tunnel, maybe a long journey. But it does get better. And I know that when I was struggling, both before my transition, during and afterwards, when I was struggling as an actor, an unemployed actor, and seemingly unemployable, my mum, my darling late mother, would say, you know, something will turn up, something will come your way. She always used to quote something her father used to say, so my grandfather. She said, what's meant for you won't pass you by. You know, in other words, if you believe in fate, and whether that's something of a religious sense or just fate, karma, call it what you will.
I know
it sounds corny, but dreams do come true. I walk onto the stage of the Globe Theatre almost every night, and I can't believe my luck because I spent 20 years in the audience looking up at the actors on that stage, yearning, pining, aching to be in their place. And now I am. I am on that stage. I am working in that theatre as an actor. And I count my lucky stars every day. So, yeah, that's my advice, really. Just hang in there.
I feel that I would give AJ, 15-year-old, 10-year-old, or 20-year-old AJ, the same advice. It actually gets better. And it's all about not giving up on ourselves, and it's tough. There are moments when you really think, what's the point? You know, like, seriously. But you have to keep going. And to echo something you said your mom would tell you to encourage you and to go on, my mom would always say everything was not fixed, because I would tend to see things like, oh, that's what it is, so it's always going to be that way. I would really get stuck, even as a teenager, that way. She would also say, no, that's today. Tomorrow's going to be something different. And she would also always say, I'll surround you with love and light. And so these are my last words to you. Surround you with light and love. And I really hope that you just keep doing all this wonderful work. And I actually really hope that I will get back to London one day and I will see you perform at the Globe.
I hope so too.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, for your time.
Thank you, AJ. It's absolutely gorgeous to see you again and to talk and to remember and to look to the future.
Thank you so much. And you have to understand that I would just you know, sit on my couch and switch on Netflix, and I'm watching sometimes like, oh my God, it's Rebecca. And I was just so thrilled to see someone living their best life, like doing what they had intended to do. So it's always been inspiring to me.
Yeah. Oh, bless you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today. I hope you've been able to identify how you can integrate innovation and creativity in your daily life. If you would like to dive in or know more, you can contact me on my website, innovcrea.com. Special thanks to Millimétrique, who composed my music themes. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.